Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. We're here every week at this time. If you're a new listener, welcome. If you are a regular listener, thank you for tuning in again. I've got a show lined up for you today where we're going to talk about a couple different topics. I'm going to be interviewing very shortly Mr. Alan Hall, who is with the Socionomics Institute Division of Elliott Wave International, and we're going to talk to him about the very fascinating science of socionomics. And I'm also going to talk today about portfolio considerations that you may not have thought about. We're going to talk about, in the second segment of today's program, what you might consider holding in your portfolio that many of the super wealthy are holding up to 25% of in their portfolio. That's in the second segment of today's program. And in the last segment of today's program, we're going to talk about really a quote from Winston Churchill and how it relates to your investing strategies. He said, the further you look into the past, the further you can see into the future. It's a very profound quote, and we'll be taking a look at the history of money in the last segment of today's program. Our new retirement rules classes are over for the year. However, we do have a special one-night class coming up for those between the ages of 55 and 65 titled, Are You Making or Will You Make These Social Security Collection Mistakes? The event will be held on December the 9th at the Highlands Golf Club. It will begin at 6 p.m. and conclude promptly at 7:30 p.m. when a complimentary dinner will be served. You can register. We expect that tickets for this event will go very quickly. Tickets are free. However, you'll have to limit your ticket request to no more than four because seating is limited. Go to newretirementrules.com and register for the event. The website, again, New Retirement Rules. We've got a special announcement there for the Social Security Collection Mistakes meeting. So, again, December 9th. Beginning at 6, concluding at 7:30. The website, newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have on the program Mr. Alan Hall. Mr. Hall is a writer for the Socionomics group at Elliott Wave, and Mr. Hall's had a lot of experience in the private sector as a builder. He has been studying Elliott Wave analysis and Socionomics since 1995, and it's terrific to have him on the program. So, Alan, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you, Dennis.
Alan, let's talk, Alan, about socionomics. I think maybe some of our listeners aren't familiar with the term, but it's a fascinating science.
Yeah, well, the core precept is, if you boil it down, most people think that events cause movements in the stock market and change the public mood or the social mood. Socionomics flips that on its head. We think the social mood changes the character of events. And one of the main reasons we think that is because a major social mood change, as reflected by the stock market, tends to precede events of the same kind of character. So history shows that stock markets are leading indicators for many social expressions, and these include economic activity, social polarization, skirt lengths, I'm sure you've heard of that, and the character of movies and TV shows, skyscraper construction, authoritarianism, war and peace, and the list just goes on. And this is not because stock markets somehow cause these activities. It's because the stock market is a barometer of society's mood. When mood's trending positively, people feel more optimistic and confident. And among other manifestations, they buy stocks. When mood's trending negatively and the stock market is declining, they feel more pessimistic and fearful. And among other manifestations, they sell stocks. A country's freely traded stock market is the best indicator we know of to measure social mood. And the cool thing is the data goes back three centuries. It's highly granular. It's pretty accurate. It's the best data series we have on that kind of behavior that reflects optimism and pessimism. And so history shows that the longer a society undergoes a pessimistic and fearful psychological state, the more they seem to be susceptible to epidemics. It's almost as if society is fluctuating between states of robustness and weakness, and that the social mood trend is driving it. So if I can give you a little background on this idea, then we can discuss the Ebola epidemic.
Be very timely. Yeah, please do.
Yeah. Well, if you can put up that chart of London's cholera epidemics, we've seen the same pattern time and time again.
Alan, let me jump in there just because we're on radio, so the listeners. Alan has forwarded some charts, and it's basically a chart of stocks. And it's interesting how stocks seem to bottom at the time that there were cholera epidemics in London. So the chart is really just showing the correlation between the level of stocks and these epidemics. So let me have you jump in from there.
Sure. What we've got here is a giant peak in stock prices in 1825. That was called the Poyi Mania. And then the panic of 1825 is the big crash. And after that, you've got this long sideways bear market. And within that sideways bear market, there are some significant sharp downturns and four cholera epidemics. And these really sharp downturns preceded these cholera epidemics. And so what's going on is that the negative social mood puts pressure on people. The economy suffers. People undergo stress, fear. Sanitation gets neglected. Londoners couldn't afford to empty their cesspits, which were open sewers under their houses. And these things overflowed and contaminated the shallow wells they were drinking from. This happened at social mood lows. Society was weakest in 1849. When social mood was most negative and stocks hit a multi-century low, and that's when cholera deaths peaked in London.
So let's talk about you were kind enough to forward a number of charts here. Let's fast forward this if we could to maybe the last century here in the United States, because it's interesting how that correlation continues when you look at U.S. stocks and epidemics that occurred here in the United States.
Yeah, we've got a I hope your people can see this on the YouTube video. We've got a chart here of inflation-adjusted U.S. stocks and major epidemics highlighted there. Again, we see that the long periods of negative social mood tend to precede major epidemics. What's going on, we think, is that in large degree, negative mood trends, society tends to display increasing pessimism about the future that builds to a pervasive extreme. People get as pessimistic as they can, and then it reverses, the trend reverses. But this pessimism shows up quickly in stock price declines and credit contraction, and later in lagging economic effects, including macroeconomic contraction, unemployment, falling incomes, foreclosures, homelessness, and declines in socioeconomic status. And each of these researchers have associated with negative health consequences. So this pessimistic social psychology and its manifestations combine to increase chronic stress. And that's a condition associated with reduced immune response, mental health problems, and other aspects of societal morbidity. So we think long periods of such stress make society more susceptible to epidemics.
If you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. Alan Hall, who's an expert in socionomics. And, Alan, we've got just a couple minutes left in this segment. Tie this in, if you would, and we can pick it up in the next segment also, to we have this Ebola situation that's making headlines. Certainly it's maybe not reached epidemic proportions yet, but certainly in Africa it probably has. How is that reflective upon social mood, or is it?
Well, to look at African social mood, we will look at Western Africa stocks, because that's where the epidemic started, and that's where the social stress reached or increased prior to the epidemic. So, yeah, we've got a chart on that, but we saw the same kind of thing with the SARS epidemic and the H1N1 flu in 2009. In fact, both of those epidemics were highly correlated with the lows in global stocks.
Interesting. Well, we are going to continue our conversation with Mr. Alan Hall when Everything Financial Radio returns. And Alan, just in the few seconds, I should say, we have left, if someone wanted to learn more about your work, which I find to be fascinating, what would you have them do?
Go to socionomics.net, which is our website, and you can browse around in there. We have a search box. We have video, audio, and written material there that you can look at. We also publish The Socionomist, our monthly publication, and we've been doing that since 2009. So there's certainly plenty there to read.
All right. Well, I'd encourage the listeners to do that, and we will continue our conversation with Mr. Alan Hall when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'm really glad you decided to tune in today, and I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Mr. Alan Hall of the Socionomics Institute and Elliott Wave International, and I'll continue my conversation with him in the next segment. You know, I was looking at some articles this past week, as I often do, and I found a CNBC article that was titled, Rich Hoard Cash as Their Wealth Reaches Record High. Rich Hoard Cash as Wealth Reaches Record High. I'll give you just a little bit from this article. The amount of individuals that hold more than $30 million in assets has climbed to a new record in 2014, according to a global survey on Wednesday, which also warned that a lack of diversification meant that this wealth is not protected from shocks to the financial system. I'll talk about what that means here in just a moment. Over 12,000 of these new ultra-high net worth individuals, again, these are folks with more than $30 million in assets, were minted in the year ending June 2014, according to WealthX and UBS World Ultra Wealth Report. This is a 6% increase from the prior year, which means that globally, these millionaires with more than $30 million in assets now is at a record level of over 211,000. Now, there was an investment officer from UBS Wealth Management who was interviewed during the article, and he was talking about some risks that the wealthy are facing. And he pointed out that these ultra-high net worth individuals are holding nearly 25% of their assets in cash. And in the interview, he said, that's an amount that is far higher than he would recommend in a diversified portfolio. Well, I'm not sure exactly where this chief investment officer would suggest that the wealthy keep their cash, but let me give you a differing perspective, and a perspective that I think has some implications for your portfolio as well, potentially. I want to share with you in this segment why I believe the wealthy may be right. I'm going to share with you why I think it makes sense for many folks to consider holding a fair amount of cash in their portfolio, and 25% may not be a bad number considering personal facts and circumstances. Reason number one is that if there's an asset price bubble, cash assets preserve wealth when the bubble bursts. And let me just give you a few quick examples. Let's just imagine that 10 years ago, in 2004, you took all the real estate that you owned and you sold it, and you converted that real estate asset to a cash asset. You took the cash from the sale of your real estate, and maybe you just buried it in the backyard or put it in a money market account. You got really no yield to speak of because there's been no yield. The real estate bubble then collapsed. Today, if you take a look at how much real estate that cash would buy, you could buy more real estate with the same cash today than you could in 2004. See, when there's an asset price bubble that exists, cash can help protect that asset because you don't lose money in cash. Now, admittedly, this is facts and circumstances driven by an individual. You've got to look at what your own personal facts and circumstances are. But cash with no yield might be better than having assets parked in an asset where there may be an asset price bubble. We can look at the stock bubble back in 2000 to 2002. We had a correction of more than 50%. Had you taken all your money out of stocks in 2000, put the money in cash, and then bought stocks again in 2002, you'd have purchased a lot more stock with the same level of cash. The same thing could be said of the stock market bubble that really started to collapse in July of 2007. It didn't bottom until March of 2009, 20 months later. had you in June of 2007 taken all the assets you had in stock, converted it to cash, and then decided you were going to buy stock again in 2009, you'd have purchased a lot more stock. So here's my question for you to consider. Do the super wealthy get super wealthy by making bad money decisions? Could it be that these ultra-high net worth folks know something that maybe the chief investment officer that was quoted in the article doesn't know? Now, if you've been a long-time listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you know that we talk about economic seasons. And these economic cycles or sub-cycles exist for 15 to 20 years before the next cycle kicks in. Well, during an autumn economic cycle, easy money policies lead to asset bubbles. Then we go to a winter season when asset price bubbles burst as debt is purged from the system. Now, easy money policies lead to asset price bubbles. I've already discussed the real estate bubble. I've already pointed out two stock market bubbles. But if I go back to one point in history, and there are many that I could refer to, I'm just going to pick one in the interest of time. In the 1860s, money was linked to gold. An ounce of gold sold for $20.67 an ounce as it had for almost 30 years. Now, when the country's on a gold standard, there's a problem, especially if you want to spend a lot of money, because you can only print paper money to the extent that you have gold to back it up. Well, President Lincoln needed to finance the Civil War, so he changed the backing of money through banking acts. Instead of having money backed by gold, he had money backed by gold and government debt. Easy money policies followed, asset bubbles followed, and predictably these asset bubbles burst. And one example was railroad bonds. There was a company, the Jay Cook Company, went bust during that time frame. Now, there's a lesson here, and here's why I bring this up. During this time frame, there were some wealthy folks that got even wealthier. Andrew Carnegie, Rockefeller, those names probably sound familiar. Well, why did they get wealthy? They had cash. Because when the asset price bubbles burst, they had cash to buy assets at fire sale prices. Now, the question, of course, comes up, are we in an asset price bubble today? Well, let's look at the stock market. Stocks are up more than 200% since 2009. That's significant in just a five-year time frame. The Fed has printed more than $4 trillion of new money. Last year, stocks were up 30% and corporate profits were up 3%. Those numbers don't sync up when you do some simple math. Now, I'm not suggesting a stock market crash is imminent. I'm not suggesting that you put all your assets in cash, and I'm not suggesting you do any of this without looking at your personal situation. But what I am suggesting is this. Cash may be smart in some of your portfolio. These ultra-high net worth folks may know something that perhaps some of the chief investment officers are not aware of. Now, many of you probably are aware also that our new retirement rules classes are now finished for the year. You'll have to wait till next year to attend a new retirement rules class. However, we do have a special one-night event coming up. This is for those that are between the ages of 55 and 66 who are planning for retirement or who are already retired, again, between the ages of 55 and 66. And the event is titled, Are You Making or Will You Make These Social Security Collection Mistakes? We've had requests to make a meeting available to talk about Social Security collection strategies. And certainly, when you look at yield on investments, when you look at the rather precarious situation that exists in the economy, you certainly want to make sure you're getting the most from your Social Security program. So at the meeting, we'll talk about potentially increasing Social Security benefits by up to 30%. We'll talk about free spousal benefit collections, even if you're divorced. We'll talk about taxation on Social Security benefits. We'll talk about coordinating Social Security with personal savings and investments. And we'll talk about the future of Social Security. The meeting will be one night. It will be held on Tuesday, December 9th. It'll be held at the Highlands Golf Club, which is located at 2715 Leonard Street Northwest in Grand Rapids. The meeting will begin at 6 p.m., and we'll conclude at 7:30 p.m., and there will be a complimentary dinner served as well. So again, December 9, the Highlands Golf Club, beginning at 6, concluding at 7:30 p.m., when a complimentary dinner will be served. All you have to do is go look at the special notice that we've posted at newretirementrules.com. You can register there while capacity remains. We do expect this event to fill up fairly quickly, so if you have an interest, go to newretirementrules.com and register while capacity remains. I'll be back after this with Mr. Alan Hall. Stay with me.
Give me your money, just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I have on the program with me today Mr. Alan Hall. Alan is a contributor to the Socionomist magazine and also is a contributor and a researcher, I should say, at Elliott Wave International. It's great to have you on the program, Alan, and I'm just going to have you kind of jump in where you left off. We were talking about the relationship between social mood as measured by stock market levels and the onset of these global epidemics. And you were talking about SARS and the bird flu. And for our listeners maybe that are just kind of picking it up at the end of the last segment and joining us, can we go back and kind of start the conversation there?
Sure. I've given you a chart there of three sociometers, we call them, the inflation-adjusted Dow Jones Industrial Average, the World Stock Index, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng Stock Index. And those are plotted against the cumulative cases and deaths of the SARS epidemic and in 2003, and cumulative cases of H1N1 flu, the pandemic that began in early 2009. And it's very easy to see that both of these epidemics, one epidemic, one pandemic, began very near the stock market lows in those three sociometers. And most global stocks reflected those same kinds of fluctuations, lows in early, late 2002, early 2003, and then again in 2009. So the timing of these things, we don't think that's an accident. We've seen it happen too many times, and so what we're saying here is that there's an increased risk of an epidemic outbreak during bear markets and near their end. This doesn't mean that every bear market is going to produce an epidemic outbreak, and it doesn't mean that every bull market is going to be free of one. What it means is that the likelihood of an epidemic is greater after these socially stressful periods when prices are plunging and people are fearful and pessimistic, and generally there's an elevated level of social stress. We think this changes behavior in many ways and affects things that make us more prone to get sick.
So let me let the listeners know also that these charts will be available at everythingfinancialradio.com. So if you happen to be listening to this traditional radio or podcast, you can go to everythingfinancialradio.com and download the charts. So let's just take a look, and let's go back and talk about this Ebola outbreak. When you look at the stock market, certainly here in the United States since 2000, at least on a nominal basis, stocks are much higher. On a real basis, you might say that given the value of the dollar, that they're not that much higher. What's your outlook for stocks, and how do you tie that into social mood and potentially where this Ebola outbreak might end up?
Yeah, well, the cool thing about my job is I don't have to try to forecast the stock market. I rely on Elliott Wave International to do that, and their outlook is fairly well known. They're anticipating a large bear market. The cool thing about socionomics is that the stock market does X and society generally does Y. The stock market's a leading indicator for so many kinds of social behaviors, and you can see the character of social behavior changing as stock markets rise or as they decline in large degree moves. And at the turning points, you see significant kinds of behaviors that repeat over time. At least their character is similar. Tremendous optimism at the tops and tremendous pessimism at bottoms. along with a lot of other associated manifestations. Speaking of optimism, I've got a chart here that shows chicken and antibiotics. And what we've got is titled growth at all costs. And here I'm drawing some parallels between the things that positive social mood produced since World War II. In the top line, we've got antibiotics, all the data that's available for the millions of pounds of antibiotics sold in the U.S. The second line is pounds per capita of U.S. annual chicken consumption. Antibiotics launched northward, and chicken consumption also launched northward. The third line is U.S. consumer credit outstanding, and the fourth line is the U.S. GDP. And the point here is that antibiotics are to chicken production as credit is to the economy. It's sort of an artificial stimulant. And, you know, it's a trend that was set up by the positive mood desire for growth and the complacency that's born of optimism that we can just, you know, produce and use as much antibiotics as we want and produce and use as much credit as we want, and there won't be any consequences. But this trend laid the ground for subsequent weakness. I mean, now we have antibiotic-resistant superbugs on the horizon and active infections going, and a lot of scientists are calling, you know, for the post-antibiotic era and antibiotic-resistant diseases of all kinds. So we think the blowback from this extensive use of credit, or overuse of credit, and the overuse of antibiotics is just beginning. So we think social mood is largely driving all these behaviors in similar fashions.
So do you see social mood worsening moving ahead then?
I've been around this long enough now to know that social mood can fool you for a long time, and so can stock markets. These periods of optimism and pessimism, they come in different sizes. And we've never experienced one of this size if Elliott Wave International's Elliott Wave count is accurate, and it seems to be. And at these turning points, you get this tremendous mix of positive and negative social expression. It's sort of like a flock of birds trying to decide which way to go, or a herd of animals. And finally, they choose a direction, and then the major trend changes. But trying to call a peak in a 300-year rise in social mood is a pretty tough job. So we see a big mix of things right now. I mean, there's a lot of fear, but mixed with a lot of optimism. And our main sociometer continues to be the stock market. And we think that it will continue, as it always has, to be a leading indicator for the social expressions that come next.
So, Alan, has it been – Elliott Wave is predicting that we will see a pretty significant bear market as far as stocks are concerned, and certainly I would agree with that. Does that mean, then, that, you know, we might see more of these epidemics? We might see more disease outbreaks? I mean, does one go hand-in-hand with the other?
Well, it increases the likelihood that we will see that. It also increases the likelihood that we'll see various other negative health manifestations. For example, I've got a chart here called Four Sociometers Agree. It's been a bear market. And it shows the inflation-adjusted Dow and U.S. Consumer Confidence Index and the World Stock Index valued in gold. And at the bottom of the chart, the U.S. suicide rate. And all of these charts peaked in 2000 in a very significant way, the top three did. And the U.S. suicide rate hit a low in 2000, and it's been climbing since. I believe I read a statistic the other day. There's a suicide every 13 minutes in the U.S. now. These feelings of despair and hopelessness are, we think, influenced by the social mood trend. People don't see their future as being as bright as they did 10 or 20 years ago. And that is a shared feeling, we think, that's widely shared in an unconscious way. And it influences the social actions that follow. So if we could move to the Ebola chart now.
And let me, before you just jump in there, let me just say that we will have these charts available at everythingfinancialradio.com, but Alan's doing a terrific job just explaining the correlation between these this data. So, yeah, please jump in and let's talk about Ebola, which has certainly been making news here of late.
Sure. Well, we chose the Western Africa Market Vectors Nigeria Focus Western Africa Index as the appropriate sociometer to look at this area where Ebola erupted. And our chart is the number of deaths in our chart is not updated, but the timing is what is important here. Western Africa social mood's been in a bear market for a number of years, since 2008, and it just hasn't recovered very much. This puts a lot of stress on people, on individuals. We think it lowers their immunity and makes them more susceptible. There have been a lot of different Ebola outbreaks in Africa, but never one that was this virulent or got into major cities as this one has. And so we think this long period of negative social mood set up the conditions and that were favorable to an outbreak happening, and here we've got one. So now you might ask, how can this perspective help public health officials and epidemiologists? The best illustration of that might be the AIDS epidemic. And I've got a chart here for you of the AIDS epidemic, which also followed a major bear market. And in inflation-adjusted terms, it was the second-largest bear market in the past century. From 1966 to 1982, the AIDS epidemic began sometime around 1981. And if you see what could be the beginning of a disease outbreak, as doctors and scientists did in the early 80s, the first thing you ought to do is assess the social mood trend of that society. The socionomic perspective would have saved lives back in the early 1980s when the American government completely ignored the emerging AIDS epidemic. It wasn't until 1986, when infections were skyrocketing and more than half the hemophiliacs in the U.S. were infected because the blood supply got contaminated. Only then did the government issue its first major statement on preventing the spread of AIDS. So, more recently, global health officials blamed world leaders for failing to organize a stronger response to the Ebola outbreak. If the CDC and the WHO had the socioeconomic perspective and they'd seen that chart, they might have known that the likelihood of a serious epidemic in Western Africa was high, and they might have acted earlier and more strongly back in March, when the first cases popped up. Now, you know, they have quite a challenge in front of them anyway with the poor healthcare system in Africa. But instead, now this is the deadliest Ebola outbreak in history, and the WHO's, you know, declared it an international public health emergency. It spread to the United States in a very controlled fashion so far. The military's involved, the U.S. military. So, the emergency coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in Guinea said, everything we do is too small and too late. We're always running after the epidemic. And scientists have said now it could last another 12 to 18 months and infect a lot more people. So, we think there's a way to at least get a little bit of a heads up on what's going on. And on the susceptibility of a population to an outbreak like that.
Well, Alan, we're going to have to leave it there. The clock is ticking. We certainly appreciate you being with us today. Our guest today has been Mr. Alan Hall. You can check out his work at socionomics.net. I'd encourage you to do that. Thanks for being with us, Alan. We hope you'll come back.
Sure, appreciate it. Thank you much, Dennis.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm Dennis Tubergen. We are here every week at this time, and I want to take just a moment to thank special guest today, Mr. Alan Hall from the Socionomics Institute, as well as Elliott Wave International. We talked in a prior segment about the importance of potentially looking at considering having some cash in your portfolio. In this segment, I want to look at really another portfolio allocation consideration. And the big topic for this segment is going to be the history of money. You know, Winston Churchill said, "The further you look into the past, the farther you can see into the future." If you go all the way back and look at money, you can go all the way back, in fact, 5,000 years as far as Egypt. And it was in Egypt 5,000 years ago that gold and silver was first used as currency. Prior to that time, the barter system was used. Now, at this time, gold and silver was not really yet money because the gold and silver that was being used in commerce was not uniform in size. So it made trade a bit difficult. It was a bit of a guessing game. You didn't know exactly how much gold might be there, but that's where really money got its start. Now, this conversation really cannot be had in a relevant way without talking about the difference between currency and money. Currency is a medium of exchange, and currency has to be durable. Currency has to be portable. It's got to be easier to carry around, and it's got to be divisible. You have to be able to make change. Now, money is all those things as well. Money is durable, portable, and divisible. But money should also be, and this is key, a store of value over a long period of time. Now, most, even in the financial industry, from my experience, don't understand this. Currency is durable, portable, and divisible, but money is also durable, portable, divisible, and it has to be a store of value, a good store of value for a long period of time. Now, the paper bills that you have in your pocket are currency. They're durable, they're portable, and they're divisible. But more can be printed. So it's really not a good store of value for all your assets for the long term, in my view. Let me just ask you a simple question. What happens when more money is printed? The Federal Reserve has printed $4 trillion since the financial crisis. Well, the simple answer to that question is that existing bills lose value. When more money is created, when more currency, I should say, is created, it transfers wealth from you to the government and the banking system. Now, we talked about cash as being an important part of the your portfolio, at least a good consideration, an important consideration for your portfolio, but something tangible may also be an important consideration. Now, when I talk about something tangible, gold and silver are most commonly used. Now, gold and silver over the long term have held their value. Now, there is a perspective floating around out there. In fact, many companies that are in the business of selling gold and silver will explain that gold has really gone up in value. In fact, from 1971 to the present, gold has gone from $35 an ounce to about $1,200 an ounce. So has gold really gone up in value? The answer to that is no, not really. Gold has just been a better store of value over the long term than the U.S. dollar. The dollar has lost value. In fact, if you calculate the inflation rate and take a look at what a dollar would buy in 1971, it would take about $5.85 to buy the same thing today. See, the U.S. dollar, as well as every other currency in the world today, is a fiat currency. It doesn't have a direct link to something tangible. And when you look at fiat currencies, 100% of the time, the value of fiat currencies has gone to zero. If you look at the fiat currencies that have existed historically, and look at the ones that, when spelled, started with a letter A and you took half those that started with the letter B, you would have 600 different fiat currencies that have existed historically, and 100% of them have gone to zero. So the question is, will the U.S. dollar or yen or euro be the first to reverse this 100% historical trend? Well, since 1913, when the Federal Reserve was formed, the U.S. dollar has lost more than 95% of its purchasing power. So since that time, by anyone's measure, over the last 100 years, the U.S. dollar has not been a very good store of value. In fact, in 1913, a $20 gold piece had 1 ounce of gold. Today, gold's at about $1,200 an ounce. Now, when you look at currencies and read the headlines when it comes to currencies, you see that the Japanese yen since 2012 is down 30% against the dollar. What does that mean? Does that mean that the dollar is getting stronger? Well, relative to the yen, maybe, but what it really means is that the yen is losing value faster than the U.S. dollar is losing value. You know, if you go back again and think about that Winston Churchill quote, he said, the further you look into the past, the further you can see into the future. If you go back and look at what President Lincoln did in the 1860s, Lincoln backed the U.S. dollar with government debt along with gold, and the dollar lost 50% of its purchasing power as a result, and the link to gold was restored in 1879, and the dollar regained its purchasing power. In fact, from 1791 to 1933, point to point, not in the interim, but point to point, the dollar bought about the same amount of goods and services in 1791 as it did in 1933. So point to point over that 142-year time frame, the dollar was a pretty good store of value. But since that time, the dollar has not been a very good store of value. So if we go back and look at our definitions of currency and money, money has to be a good store of value for a long period of time. A fiat currency really doesn't meet that test. So here are some questions to consider. Given the U.S. is fundamentally broke, will the money printing stop? What do you think? Will the U.S. dollar buy more in 5 years than it buys today? And what are you doing about it? And I would encourage you to check out your portfolio and consider adding something tangible to your portfolio. Of course, all this is dependent upon your individual facts and circumstances. I want to take a minute as I close the program to remind you that our new retirement rules classes are over for the year. However, we do have a special one-night event coming up on December the 9th. It's designed for those between the ages of 55 and 66, and the title of the event is, Are You Making or You Will or Will You Make the Social Security Collection Mistakes? We'll talk about how to potentially get more from the Social Security system. We'll talk about different ways to collect Social Security, a lot of different strategies. And to get more information, you can go to newretirementrules.com. You can register there as well. The meeting will begin Tuesday, December 9th at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. when a complimentary dinner will be served. Tickets will go fast. If you're interested, go to newretirementrules.com and register. That's all the time I have for this week. Hope you enjoyed our program, and hope you'll tune in again next week. Bye.